Morning.
Morning.
If you'd like to open your Bible to Luke chapter 14, you can put your ribbon there or something. We'll come back to this text at the end of the lesson. But I want to begin by reading this short little illustration that Jesus uses here in his teaching. Luke chapter 14 and verse 28, Jesus says, "For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This man began to build, but he was not able to finish.'" I don't know about you, but I, in my life, can relate to this dude in the parable. Starting projects and never getting around to finishing them. Around the house, I was just thinking about some of the projects that I've got going on. Years and years ago, I started building a playhouse for the kids that I still have never put the trim on the windows or the doors. And at this point, the kids are too big for the playhouse. And the playhouse is now a shed for pool supplies and chicken stuff. Speaking of chickens, I built a pretty decent chicken coop a few years ago, but I've never finished trimming it out either. I've got all the wood, I've got the paint, I've got everything that I need. It's sitting in the garage. I just have never gotten around to actually finishing that project. There's still a huge mess in the basement from where I replaced the basement stairs a couple years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and saw one of the foundation walls. I needed to do some tuck pointing and replastering on it. I've got the Portland cement and everything sitting down in the basement, but never gotten around to finishing that project. I almost want to say that I finished the retaining wall at the house this last summer, but in truth, I only tried to tackle a portion of the overall scope of the retaining wall that I planned to do. And even that, I didn't finish up because I still have never replaced the skirt around the bottom of the deck. And boy, I'll tell you what, I've got a bajillion leaves underneath there now that I'm going to have to get down there in the spring and dig them out so I don't have a problem. And so I'm sure that if you asked Stephanie, she could probably come up with a few more projects around the house that I've started and not finished. But that gives you a little sampling of where I'm coming from. And I realize that my propensity to start a project and never get around to finishing it is not limited to projects around the house. The young men that I was with in this room for the last 6 months could probably attest to the fact that we started a lot of projects. We started studying a lot of subjects, and I had kind of a plan of where we would go with that. And before we ever finished most of them, almost all of them, we would get sidetracked on some other side quest that then became the new thing that we were studying about. And we never did circle back and finish up many of those things. We still need to work on, guys, our master list of what we need to be as husbands one day. All right, that was one of the first projects we started, and we never came back and finished that up. But I realized also, as I was going through and doing some planning for this year in my preaching, that this is something that I've done in my preaching over the years. Usually at the beginning of the year, each year I try to come up with some sort of a theme or some sort of a plan that gives me some sort of rough structure of lesson planning, and I try to plot out when I'm going to preach what lesson and the different topics and things like that throughout the year. And I realized as I was putting my list together for 2026 that I have a lot of unfinished business from previous years. And so I'm going to try to tie up some of those loose ends this year. That's actually going to be my theme this year, is tying up loose ends, especially in my preaching. And what I want to do this morning is I want to share with you guys what we missed, or what I missed, and therefore you missed out on, as far as lessons that were supposed to be presented over the years, so that you have an idea and an expectation of me now, so that come the end of the year, you can be like, hey, You didn't get to all those things, right? It'll help to hold me accountable, right? And I found for myself, and this is maybe just a good principle in general, that when you keep things to yourself, one of two things happens. Either you forget about it, right? Because it's just like never been vocalized. It's never been put down on paper, which is one of the reasons why they tell you, you know, you need to write your goals down. Because a goal that's not written down is really just a wish and a dream. And so I know for myself, if I don't say things out loud, I will forget them. Okay, so that's one reason why I'm going to share with you today what the plan is for this year. But really, the second is, when you keep something a secret or all to yourself, you miss out on the great benefit of being held accountable by others. When you let other people know what your commitments are going to be and what your plan is going to be, and you can ask them to, you know, keep my toes to the fire on that. Don't let me fail in this area. And this is true if you're struggling with the temptation, if you're struggling with the sin, if you have a goal or something that you're wanting to accomplish. Letting other people know what your plans and intentions are, it's a great motivating factor to actually follow through on those things. And that's what I want to do this year, is follow through on some things. So let me share with you some of the stuff that we've missed and what you can expect to hear over the course of the preaching at some point throughout 2026. Years ago, in 2019, I talked about the idea that our society is changing. And just for context, 2019, by the way, was pre-COVID, okay? So all the way back before all that happened. I talked about the fact that our society is changing, and that it looked to me like it was coming to a point where holding Christian or biblical views would not only one day be unpopular, but that holding such views was going to be challenged by our society, and it was going to be persecuted in our society, and in some cases even outlawed in our society. And I suggested to us way back then that we needed to be ready for that inevitability. And it's interesting to me how, over the course of the last 6 years, it has become increasingly unpopular in our society to hold to biblical truths, and how even there have been time periods, even in our country, where something as simple as assembling together with your Christian family to worship has been outlawed, at least for a period of time. And so I told us we need to be ready for that because it's coming. And I suggested back then that if we can't stand for God when it's easy to stand for God, we most definitely won't be able to stand for God when we're actually put to the test. And further, I suggested that the ability to be able to stand firm and hold fast was not to just know what we believe, but to know why we believe what we believe. And so I presented a series of lessons in which I tried to lay out for us why we should believe certain things that were culturally taboo to talk about, or to even suggest that you might go against. And so we covered topics like abortion and homosexuality and the importance and sanctity of marriage. We talked about how God is not an anti-feminist, that he actually supports women. We talked about the fact that there is objective truth. You can know certain things for certain, that racism is wrong, that there's only one true church, that socialism is not a biblical concept, and that men should be men, right? Because if one thing has become true over the last half decade, it's that men are evil and masculinity is toxic. And yet I believe that we need to know why men should be men so that we don't become a bunch of pansies who fail to stand up for what's right and lead people to God. But there was one topic in this series that I had planned to talk about that I never got around to. And yet I think it is very important, especially for men, and that is knowing why you believe that pornography is devastating. And so that was a topic that I felt even back in 2019 we needed to address. We had a lot of young men, especially coming up in 2019, that a lesson like that probably would have been helpful to. And I will apologize for my failure to you guys. But we'll come around and get to it here in 2026 and talk about that and some of its implications. In 2022, I had a series that I called Back to Basics, where we took a very simplified, basic look at some fundamental biblical topics or things that pertain to our faith and our walk and our relationship with God. And so I covered things like some just general information about the Bible. We talked about the days of creation. We briefly outlined the 17 periods of biblical history. We talked about what the church is. We talked about the Lord's Supper and why that's important. We also talked about things like the problem of sin. We talked about who God is and why I should even care about that. We talked about the gospel. And then we talked about how to respond to the gospel. And we talked about the right baptism that we need to have in order to become a true disciple of the Lord. And so we talked about a lot of topics in our Back to the Basics series, but there was one topic that I never got to. And that was a basic lesson on understanding grace, which is one of the most fundamental Christian principles that there is. And yes, it's true, and you probably think of the fact that I've talked about grace over the years, even since 2022, but I never did the lesson that I was planning to do in this series on grace, which is a very basic lesson on grace. And so I want to come back here in 2026 and talk about that again, because the reality is in my opinion, with a topic like grace, I don't think you can talk about it too much. And so even though we've talked about it quite a bit, I want to talk about it again with you this year. In 2023, we asked ourselves some uncomfortable questions. We tried to step outside of our comfort zone a little bit. And there were some things, there are some topics, some questions that I believe are oftentimes either misunderstood or sometimes misrepresented or maybe oversimplified by those in the church. Sometimes we overstate the case sometimes for something, and so we end up then drawing some hard and fast rules, or at least giving the appearance that we're trying to make something that really is a gray matter. We're trying to make it an area of black and white. And I think there are a lot of topics that happens to. And we sought this year to look at some of those topics and just ask ourselves, what does the Bible really say about that? And so we talked quite extensively about this principle of judging others. In fact, I had four different lessons throughout the course of the year on that specific topic. We talked about judging between good and evil. What does the Bible say about that? We talked about judging those within the church. We talked about what does the Bible say about judging those who are outside of the church. We talked about the importance of being careful in this area of judging others, whether they're in or out of the church, as though somehow we are the supreme judge. Because when we do that, we actually are usurping a position that belongs to God. God is the judge, not you or me. And so whether we have authority or don't, we need to be careful in passing judgment, especially against other people. We talked about instrumental music, and we looked in two different lessons how God in the Old Testament was worshipped with instrumental music. And then we looked at the New Testament pattern. We saw something slightly different there. And so that's been one of those ones where I feel like oftentimes brethren have overstated their case or oversimplified it. Well, why don't you worship with the instrument? Well, because the Bible never says a single word about worshiping with the instrument. Well, that's not exactly true. And we saw that as we dug into that topic a little bit. And then this was the first time I ever preached about Christmas. But I did a lesson on what does the Bible really say about Christmas. And we looked at the narratives in Matthew and Luke, and we tried to weave them together into one cohesive story as we thought about the birth of our Lord and Savior. But there was one topic in this series that I wanted to, actually two topics, I'll get to that in a second. But one that I never got to, that I think is an important topic, and that is, what does the Bible really say about modesty? I think that's one that sometimes has been, there certainly is a traditional view on that, a traditional teaching, especially among very conservative Church of Christ brethren. And yet, I don't know that that issue is as cut and dry, black and white, as at least what I always grew up thinking that it was. And so I want to come back and talk about what does the Bible really say about modesty. And I'm going to share with you in that lesson my view on what the Bible teaches on modesty, recognizing that it's probably going to be different than the traditional conservative view. It may be different than your view on modesty, but recognizing that the reality is that modesty is something that God has given us principles to guide us. He hasn't made hard and fast rules, and so he expects us to use some judgment. And whenever God expects us to use some of our own judgment, he knows that we're not always going to judge things exactly the same as one another. And so I'm not going to make any rules in that lesson. I'll tell you what my thoughts are on it, and maybe it'll help you to think about things in a way that you've never thought about them before. But ultimately, I want to impress upon us the fact that we're all going to have to make our own decision on that based on biblical principles. Another topic in this series that I didn't get to in this series, but it was the question of what does the Bible really say about church finances? Now, that may seem familiar to you because I did ultimately come around and begin to address some questions related to church finance, but it wasn't until November of 2024, almost a whole year after I did this series, that we finally got around to talking about church finances when I introduced the topic by asking us a bunch of questions that I had about church finances and getting feedback from you all on questions that you had about it. And then we addressed things like areas where the church is authorized to expend funds. And we looked at the area of benevolence. We looked at the area of evangelism. And then I did this kind of hodgepodge lesson where I revisited some things that we had previously talked about, but there was obviously still a bunch of confusion on. And I'll be honest, after that lesson, I don't know that the water was any less muddy than it was before, but I think it's one of these topics where we're going to need to have some continued ongoing discussion about how we handle our finances as a church. But there were two topics that you guys know have been on my list of things to talk about that I've never gotten around to. And part of that was because I was still trying to solidify in my mind where I'm at with those things. And they both relate to the third category in which traditionally it's accepted that the church is authorized to expend funds. And that is in the area of edification. And so I want to have a lesson on what does the Bible say about church finances in relationship to edification and worship. But then I also want to explore the question of, should the church be in the business of owning property? Historically, where did that begin? When did that begin? Why did that begin? What is the biblical pattern on that? And how should those things shape the way we approach that question, even in 21st century United States churches? So we'll talk about some of those things and try to flesh some of those things out more throughout this year. Well, we won't try. We will. We will flesh those things out. May not be as thoroughly as we'd like, but we'll maybe have open up for more discussion on those things. Hopefully you guys remember in 2024, we went on an epic journey together, a journey through God's Word. Remember where we read through the Bible together chronologically, not Genesis through Revelation, but from the beginning to the end, right? In chronological order. And we had the daily Bible readings that I broke up, a different assignment for every month. And we journeyed our way through the Bible and we read through that. And then every month I would have kind of a summary sermon on what we had read about that previous month. And I loosely based that off of the 17 periods of biblical history as we went through. But even though you might think, well, you did cover all of our Bible readings, Josh. You did. In fact, you did an excellent job covering all of our Bible readings. I said, well, thank you for that. I really tried. There actually was one lesson that I blipped over. And it was because there wasn't actually any Bible readings for this part of biblical history. But sandwiched between the Old Testament and the New Testament is a period of history, a period 14, that we call the years of silence. It covers about 400 years of history. And even though the Bible doesn't have anything in its historical record of what happened in those 400 years, from Malachi up through the birth of Christ, there is a wealth of extra-biblical historical evidence for what happened in those years. And I wanted to present a lesson on it because I think that it sets the historical context and it sets the stage for what we read about in the gospel narratives and in the Acts narrative. And if you kind of have that historical background in your mind, some of the stuff that we do read about in the New Testament, it makes even more sense, or it becomes clearer. And so I had to blip over that because of time constraints in 2024, but I'm going to come back and talk about those 400 years of silence, which really aren't that silent from a historical perspective. So we'll talk about that some this year as well. Now, of course, in 2025, we did our best to come out of the fog as we focused our attention on God, where we looked at different aspects of his character or qualities that he possesses and who he is. And so I'm not going to read through the list of all of the different aspects of God that we focused on throughout this year, but wouldn't you know it, there was one that was on my list that I really wanted to get to because I think it's important, and I just ran out of time at the end of the year. So at some point this year, we're going to talk about God's meekness, because I think it's a really powerful point when we think about the character of God, his strength under control. And it really does, I think, encompass or it's almost like an umbrella that goes over most of the other characteristics that we talked about throughout the course of the year. And so we'll come back and we'll talk about God's meekness at some point this year. Now, I did go on some side quests over the years. That is, I didn't have a true theme or series necessarily written, but there were some subjects that I talked about over the years that kind of opened the door for a discussion, and then there was more things I had planned to talk about in those areas, and I never came back and actually talked about those things. So I'll share with you what those are so that you can be expecting them this year as well. Most of them were related to this idea of church polity, which is the idea of how a church is organized and how it functions as a group or an entity. And so we talked about the idea that the whole congregation is responsible for carrying out the mission of the congregation. And it's not that it's just the elders or the deacon's job to do the work of the church. It's not the preacher's job to do the work of the church. It's not even just exclusively the men's responsibility to carry out the work of the church. That if you are a member of this church family, you have a responsibility to help this church family do the work of this church family. We looked at Old Testament precedents and we looked at some New Testament examples of how that played out. And we saw how, yes, there may be some within the group that provide some leadership or direction, but ultimately it's the whole group that is supposed to be involved in carrying out the work of the church. Related to that, we looked pretty extensively at the biblical pattern of servant leadership. And we saw the precedent in the New Testament in particular of submitting ourselves to proven servant leaders. And we observed there that sometimes those proven servant leaders may be elders or deacons, but that it's also possible to have proven servant leaders within a congregation that doesn't have official elders or deacons in some sort of official capacity. And really, those specific lessons were preceded by a pretty in-depth discussion or study of several of us men in our Iron Sharpens Iron study. that we did. In fact, if my note's correct, we started studying this back in September of 2021, and we kind of wrapped it up in January of 2022, and then I started to present some lessons on it in 2023 to the whole congregation. And you'll remember that it was shortly after we did this study where we talked about the church being responsible for the work of the church and submitting to proven servant leaders amongst us that we made that transition from having men's only business meetings once a month to now where we have congregational meetings. Maybe not once a month, but whenever they are necessary and when we need to discuss things and discuss the business of the church. But there was a couple things related to those two particular discussions that I wanted to talk about and never got around to. We talked about the fact that we're all responsible to carry out the work of the church. And I thought to myself, well, it would be pretty important for us to understand then, what is the work of the church? I mean, if we're all responsible for executing it, carrying it out, we probably ought to know the scope of what we're supposed to be doing. And I had intended to talk about that, and I'd started making notes on it, and I never did get back around to doing that. So we'll talk about what is the work of the church this year from a biblical perspective. And then, if we are supposed to submit ourselves to proven servant leaders amongst us, well, it would be pretty handy if we knew how to identify those guys and gals, wouldn't it? And so I had intended to talk about how do we actually go about identifying amongst us who the proven servant leaders are. And so we'll come back and we'll discuss that a little bit more in depth this year as well. And then, guys, I had a handful of what I call miscellaneous lessons. We'll call them odds and ends lessons. Things that I had started working on and I never got around to actually presenting to the group. Years ago, we did a study in the adult class on church discipline. And we had a pretty robust discussion and study of that topic. But one of the things that was always on my mind was, okay, here's what we're supposed to do, and this is how it's supposed to work when a brother or sister gets involved in sin or a brother or sister wanders away from the faith, from the Lord. This is how we're supposed to reach out to them and discipline them, correct them, to bring them back to the fold. But what if we failed to do that? What if we didn't do our jobs? And now we have brethren who have wandered away from the safety of God's fold. They've left the Lord, and we've never done anything. What are we supposed to do now? And so I had a lesson I titled, When is it Time to Move On? Where I want to discuss what I think is the biblical loving approach to a scenario like that, which we may find ourselves in one day. I had a lesson entitled, God is Victorious, the theme of Revelation. And I started working on this in 2021. You can tell why I've not gotten around to it, because it's about Revelation. Because actually back in December of 2018, when I had people putting questions in the question box, somebody put in a question that said, could we have a lesson on the book of Revelation? And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. Let's have a lesson on one of the most confusing and misunderstood books of the Bible. So I thought, you know what, I'll just talk about the theme of Revelation. That is, however you interpret it, in the end, God's victorious. I thought that'll be good. And then, you know me, it wasn't like my favorite thing to want to work on. So I just kept putting it on the back burner, on the back burner, on the back burner. This year, we're going to finally come around and talk about it. As you notice on this slide, I number my sermons. It's just for me to keep track of things. Last year, I came to sermon number 666, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity to say, we'll talk about that text in Revelation 13 that says this is the mark of the beast. And so, again, that was more of, I can't pass up the opportunity to title lesson 666, the mark of the beast. But I never did write it. I never did get around to it. But I will come to do that this year as well. And then you guys know that last August, I presented a lesson here. It was lesson number 679, in case you were wondering, That's how many lessons you guys have heard me preach. In fact, today is 694, if you wanted to keep track of that. You guys have heard me preach a whole lot over the years. But I did a lesson on what must I know, because I've been emphasizing the fact, especially with our young people, that you don't have to know everything about what God expects out of you or everything that the Bible teaches in order to become a disciple of the Lord. But there are some things that you do need to know. There are some things that you do need to believe in order to commit your life to Him. And I think I boiled it down to three main points. You need to believe that God is, that He exists, that He's the creator of all things. You need to believe that your sin has separated you from a relationship with your creator. And you need to believe that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is the only means by which that relationship can be restored. And I asked you guys in that lesson, because I had a handout, and I said, tear the bottom of that off, and I want you to write down and anonymously put it in the question box. Tell me which one of those three points you are the most unsure about. Which ones do you still have questions about, whether you are a Christian or not? And I got a lot of responses, a lot of very thoughtful responses to that, putting my feelers out that way. And I wanted to come back and address those questions and follow up on those responses, and I just never got around to it this last year. And so it's my intention to come back and address all of those things that people, some people had some very thoughtful questions on some of the points that I brought up. And they're worth plumbing the depths of. And so I want to do that this year. That one will probably be more than just one lesson, but probably several lessons in and of itself. But that, guys, is the plan for the majority of the preaching that's going to go on over the next year. And so, since I haven't always been a good finisher, it is my intention this year to tie up all those loose ends, and hopefully in the process we will all learn some valuable lessons, we'll grow in our faith, and we'll grow in our walk with God and in our walk with one another. But let's go back to that text real quick in Luke chapter 14 as I wrap up the lesson for this morning. Because Jesus is using this illustration of a guy who starts to build a tower and then can't complete it to make a very important point. Jump back with me in the text to verse 25. Large crowds were going along with him, and he turned and he said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." And then he uses this illustration. These are some pretty harsh statements, it sounds like. You got to hate your family in order to be a disciple of Jesus. You have to hate yourself in order to be a disciple of His. And some people might hear that and be like, "What? I thought you were about love, Jesus. I thought you were about togetherness, Jesus. I thought you were about family, Jesus. I thought you were here to help, and now you're telling us to hate." Now, Jesus uses the illustration that we read, the guy building the tower, didn't calculate the cost before he began, and so he's not able to finish, and people look at his inability to bring it to fruition, and they laugh at him. He uses another illustration beginning in verse 31. "Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will he not first sit down and consider whether he has enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one who's coming with 20,000? You got an army twice the size of yours coming to attack you. Well, I can't beat that army. It would be foolish to rush headlong into battle. It's a suicide mission. So what do you do?" Well, while the other is still far away, verse 32, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. Try to negotiate. That's the smart thing. Plan ahead. Know what you're getting into. And this is the point that Jesus is making. Verse 33, "So then, none of you can be my disciples who does not give up all of his possessions." And you think, well, now I've got to become an impoverished person. Understand something. Jesus is not telling you to hate anybody. He's not telling you to hate yourself, literally. He's not telling you you have to give up everything that you own and become a pauper in order to be a disciple of his. What he's saying is that when it comes to your love for me, your commitment to me, and your trust in me, it must exceed your love and commitment and trust in anyone and anything else, so much so that in comparison, Your love looks like hatred. Your commitment looks like desertion, death. And your possessions, it looks like you have nothing. Jesus is saying, if you want to be my disciple, you need to consider that I must come first in your life all the time in every aspect of it. Before your wife and your children, before your mother and your father. In fact, you can't put your trust in anyone or anything else. You have to put all your trust in me. You can't even trust in yourself. You have to die to yourself in order to be his disciple. And Jesus is saying, this is serious business. This is not something that should be approached lightly or a haphazard decision that's made. You need to be sure that you're ready to follow through. Then you can be my disciple. So the question I'll have for you this morning is this. What have you started but not finished? Maybe you've started down your walk with the Lord. And you've kind of thought, yes, I believe in God. I believe that I need a relationship with Him. I understand and know that my sin separates me from Him. But you've stopped short of actually reestablishing your relationship with God by recommitting your life to Him, by being washed clean in the blood of the Lamb, by being baptized in water. Well, why are you waiting? If that's your intention, if that's your plan, and you've started that journey, finish what you started.